Coming up in a few minutes, we'll check in with our man in Orange County, Gustavo Arellano, about the big stories to watch there in 2024. But first, producer Juliana Mayo sits down, as she does from time to time, with a Los Angeles-based author. This one also happens to be a renowned actor.
I'm speaking today to David Duchovny. He is an author, a musician, an actor, a director. Is there anything else I should throw in there?
No, I'm incapable of doing anything but that, though.
We're talking about his new novella, The Reservoir. David Duchovny, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thanks for talking to me today.
As I said, I've read all your books in the last couple of weeks, so it's very exciting to get to talk to the mind behind it all.
Like I said, I'm sorry.
Your book takes place during COVID, and we're spending time inside a perch above Central Park with the main character, Ridley. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about him.
Well, what was funny about writing The Reservoir for me was I originally envisioned it as a short story because I'd never written one, and the idea didn't seem to have the scaffolding or the events that would hold up an entire novel. So I thought it's more like a character study, and I just thought, you know, I wanted to make fun or satirize, kind of like the Wall Street person that buys art and thinks they're an artist or thinks they have a sensitive soul because they made a lot of money and they can put it up on the wall, or worse yet, talk about it as an investment. So kind of started out that way with Ridley. He was early retired. Wasn't like a titan of the industry, but, you know, did well enough to retire to Central Park West. And as I continued to write, it was really a voyage of discovery for me because I didn't really, I knew the bare bones of what was going to happen. I knew he was going to see some lights across the way. I knew it was going to be a pandemic rear window kind of a thing. And that excited me. I thought those elements coming together was going to be interesting. But I thought this guy was a jerk at first, you know, and I kind of wanted to make him into a jerk. And then a few pages in, or maybe a little more, I started to, you know, what inevitably happens when you write is you start to feel for the characters in a way. You know, it's hard to maintain a satire. I've never tried to do it. Mm-hmm. I just kind of opened up to this guy, and, you know, I didn't make him a hero in any way. I didn't soften his edges or make him not a jerk, but I also made him, I think, three-dimensional as he went on his hero's journey.
I definitely feel like you have an affection for this man, even if you do find some of his life loathsome.
Yeah.
I think that comes across.
So that was the, you know, our writers often talk about being surprised. Mm-hmm. You know, like if they're not surprised, then the reader's not going to be surprised. So that was the biggest surprise to me. I've had other surprises when I've written plot surprises, mm-hmm. things that I never thought were going to happen.
So you're not mapping stuff out. You're just kind of going with
the flow. I do map stuff out
generally,
but not really in this one because I thought it was going to be, you know, fairly short. So mm-hmm. I kind of had a handle on what was going to happen, which wasn't all that much because it's like an interior monologue inside this guy's head.
Yeah, and in that monologue, there's this moment where that occurs in another one of your books.
Hang on a minute.
Where he kind of pinpoints the moment that a relationship fell apart, kind of from great hindsight.
What happened when did I do that in the other? Was it the Bonnie stuff in Bucky Fucking Dent?
Yes.
Ah.
Yes. We have it twice where this man realizes from a great distance, like when it all fell apart. And I'm really into understanding like why you wanted to go there and what that means to you.
Well, I think part of that is a literary convention because I'm not sure that actually is the way life works. You know, that there's not one moment, at least if it's not highly dramatic. Like, you know, I just watched you strangle my dog. I think the relationship is over, you know. It's rare that it's something as easy to do as that, you know, wash your hands of that person. Mm-hmm. But I'm fascinated with that, obviously, since I've done it twice. Thanks for pointing that out. you know, I go back to the movie Le Mépris. Do you know that, Contempt, that movie?
I don't, no.
It was shown to me, I was probably in my mid-20s, and It's kind of, I think Brigitte Bardot is in it. And this couple goes to a weekend with a very kind of masculine, powerful guy. And he kind of insults the husband and he doesn't stick up for himself. And it's like, that's it, you know, like for the girl, that was it, that moment. And I've always been kind of fascinated with that. I don't live that way. I don't like judge people like on a moment like that, but I'm fascinated with the idea of, oh, it's a complete revelation of character right in that one little moment.
This is also, since I'm just hitting you with all the stuff, this is also not the first time there's been a fever dream at the reservoir.
All right, is this almost over? This interrogation?
I'm also really into that. Let's talk about fever dreams at the reservoir.
Well, you know, you write what you know, or you write what's outside your window, in my case. Well, Reservoir was written entirely in my apartment in New York. Because we were all locked down at that point. And I think Miss Subway is referring to the kind of cocoon old people orgy in the reservoir.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from. It came from kind of cocoon. I don't know if you remember that, but they had like a water source that was giving them youth and life. And it's similar, you know, like an alien or a religious or a folktale kind of source of youth and life to these older people in the reservoir. And I think I described them as, they're having sex as being like gray eels slithering over one another, which I should probably be canceled for. That was a fever dream of the daughter, kind of imagining that her dad was out there living his best life in an orgy in the middle of the reservoir. At the age of, in his 80s or whatever he was in. So, yes, guilty. I won't do it again.
I know. I love it. I really enjoy that actually you credit people who do research for you in your books. I think a lot of people pretend they do the whole damn thing.
Well, I think you can pretend now because of, Google, right? I mean, but a good researcher can actually... is better than Google because they can, here's our AI discussion. You know, they can kind of imaginatively, if they're good at it and they're inspired and they're working with you, they can kind of read you what read your intention and start researching in areas that you might not have asked to look at. And then you go, oh my God, there it is. Wow.
You bring up a death in Venice at the end of the book, speaking of acknowledgments, and talk about its import to you and how you want it to be kind of in conversation with it. It also comes up a little bit in Bucky Fucking Dent. So clearly
Damn it.
So this is a piece that clearly means...
How does it come up in Bucky?
Oh, he talks about how he's having like a death in Venice moment or something, his dad.
The dad is?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, these are stories that shaped my consciousness, our literary consciousness, and therefore consciousness in many ways. So they're really touchstones for me. You know, I don't walk around in my life thinking death in Venice, but sometimes if I write my way into a pandemic story, I don't see how I'm, or an old man, you know, thinking about falling in love at a very old age or sex at a very old age, then I don't see how I'm going to avoid it. And in Bucky Fucking Dent, it's the latter, and in The Reservoir, it's the former.
Yeah, curious about how much meaning it holds for you. Maybe when did you read it for the first time?
I think high school. I can envision the paperback. It's Death in Venice and other stories. Tonio Kroger was another story in that. I'm not sure I went back to read it. I don't think I've read it again maybe since then. It's just like...
Just made a mark.
Some books just, they take up a place and they never let it go.
I see that you thank Chris Carter in a number of your books, and I'm really interested in how that creative relationship works for you. Is he one of your first readers? You know, he is the creator of X-Files, and it's just really interesting to me that you've maintained that relationship and that he is a part of your literary world as well as your acting world.
Yeah, he is. He has been an early reader, I think, not every book, but a few of them. Mm-hmm. And I think what I don't know if I spell it out in any of the acknowledgments or the thanks pages in the book. But really what happened to me was when I started working on the X-Files, I had really come from, you know, thinking of myself as a novelist or a poet or whatever I was, and now I was an actor, and I was on this show that was very plot-driven, because that's what drama is. It's what happens. It's not really what's thought, you know? Mm-hmm. And so at first I might have scoffed at, like, oh, well, yeah, it's got to, like, where's the beautiful writing? You know, this is beautiful plotting, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I just fell in love with plot. You know, I went back to like graduate school had like taken me beyond reading for what happens, which is, you know, what you do. You try and get underneath a book when you're in graduate school. And I kind of lost the joy of just that page turning. Oh my God. You know, the soap opera aspect of things. Mm-hmm. And the X-Files really rejuvenated my love for the drama within the written word, you know, not just the deconstruction of it, you know, which is kind of what was hot when I was in graduate school.
I feel like it, I don't know, maybe it gives you a different look at structure as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, you know, trying to write, because I ended up writing some teleplays for X-Files, and I've written scripts, and a couple of the books actually started as scripts, so they naturally have a three-act structure. An X-File would have a prologue, mm-hmm. you know, which would play before the credits, and which is usually like three or four pages. Something happens, something dramatic happens. It's going to be the case, whatever it is. And then you got three acts after that. I don't think my novels follow that structure, but they definitely have a three. I think they probably have three-act structures.
Does The Reservoir look like it's going to have a life beyond the page? Speaking of,
it's possible. I mean, I can really see it as an independent feature.
Yeah. What does Ridley look like to you?
Probably me, because you know, I'd like to do it.
Oh,
but
cool.
If I didn't do it, Ridley would look. I don't know what he'd look like if I didn't do it. He'd look like whoever was you know, hot at the time that could get me the financing. That's what he'd look like.
Your publisher sent me a new copy of The Reservoir in paperback, which is why we're talking today. And there is a short story in there called The Scare Owl, and I wonder if you could tease a little bit of it. We don't want to give the whole thing away, but, you know, give us a little taste of The Scare Owl.
If The Reservoir is like me entering into a world of Thomas Mann or Borges or Hawthorne, which are the stories that I reference in the afterword, mm-hmm. that's not childhood, but that's my early, that's the, you know, that's my education, as we've been talking about. I'm having a conversation with, they started the conversation with me when I was in high school, and like I'm responding. It's taken me a while, but I'm responding. And The Scare Owl is even younger than that, I think. It's really hearkening back to Pinocchio, which is a story that it seems so silly, but it's something that I wrote an X-File about a baseball player once who was an alien, who, and baseball made him a human. You know, like I'm fascinated with these ideas of what love can, how love can transform a nature. Mm-hmm. And The Scare Owl is in that vein of an owl. And again, it's an animal fable, like Holy Cow was. An owl that transforms himself through intention and love and loss, really. So all these stories, to me, The Unnatural, which is the X-Files episode, I'm very proud of it as a story, and The Scare Owl are really like reworkings of, I'd say, Pinocchio, which I'm sure is a reworking of, you know, it's at the heart of what it is to be human. Is like we ask ourselves what makes us human, and that's what Pinocchio is. And so I'm sure there's many, if you interrogated lots of cultures, you'd probably get lots of Pinocchio-type stories.
There's a little moment in The Scare Owl where you write, in fact, you could say that soundlessness was the owl's best weapon. Soundlessness was his deepest language. And I just found that so lovely.
Yeah. This story came about because I have a lot of glass in my house, and sometimes birds will fly into it, and it's very distressing to me. And I put things up to try and let the birds know that it's not clear air they're looking at. And one of the things I put up is a ceramic owl, you know, above mm-hmm. the on the roof. And it works for like a week. And, you know, after a week, they're like sitting on the owl. You know,
they're on to you.
But I also just love this image or this archetype of a being that makes its living being scary, being protecting and mm-hmm. yet hated, you know. So all those things were kind of rolling around my head when I went to write that one.
Dear Duchovny, it has been a real treat to get to spend some time with you today and talk. Thank you so much.
Thank you.